Wake the hell up. I don't know, Leopold. That's why I'm asking you. Does this person have a name?
I gotta go.
He started to rise, but Decker put a hand on his shoulder and held him in his seat. Speaking of Three Squares, how about some food? You look hungry. And the cops didn't feed you, did they?
How'd you know that?
You walked on a murder rap. They're pissed. They were giving you nothing. So let's order some food and kick this around.
I really do need to go.
Go where? You got somebody to meet? Maybe I'll tag along.
Why would you want to do that?
I got nowhere to be. And you look like an interesting guy. I like interesting people. There aren't enough of them in this town.
This town is full of dicks.
Dicks? Full of them, you're right. Anybody in particular dickish to you? Leopold rose, and this time Decker let him go. The bartender was staring at him. The last thing he needed was for the man to call the cops on him.
See you around, then, said Decker.
You can count on it. Leopold walked out of the bar. Decker waited about 15 seconds and then followed him out. He would trail Leopold right to wherever he called home. The only problem was that when Decker got outside, Sebastian Leopold was gone. Chapter 25. Decker walked up and down the street in both directions for 100 yards. There was one alleyway next to the bar, but it was a dead end, and no doors opened off it other than the bar's side entrance and a door to an adjacent pharmacy that was both barred and bolted shut. There were no other side streets that Leopold could have reached in 15 seconds if he'd been flat out sprinting. Decker ducked back into the bar to see if maybe Leopold had circled back in there through the side door in the alley, but he hadn't. There were a few shops that were open, but Leopold was in none of them, and no one in any of those places remembered seeing him pass by. There were no people on the street who might have witnessed anything. There could only be one answer. Someone had picked up Leopold in a car, and they had driven off. And that pickup, however absurd as it sounded, might have been prearranged. This, of course, deepened Decker's suspicion of the man, and made him doubly upset that he had managed to lose him. Yet there was nothing more to be done here, so he set off for Mansfield High. The mourners had gone and had been replaced by two groups of protesters stationed just outside the yellow police tape. One group was pro-gun, the other on the flip side of the debate. They chanted and screamed and occasionally briefly skirmished with each other. More guns, no guns. Second Amendment. Guns kill. No, people kill. Where does the slaughter end? Go to hell. Decker bypassed all this and used his new credentials to get past the security perimeter. He met up with Lancaster at the command center in the library. When he told her what had happened at the arraignment, she appeared dumbfounded.
He just walked?
Decker nodded.
Mac is going to be pissed about that. And I would have expected better from Sheila Lynch. Looks like she got blindsided by the PD.
He was just doing his job. Truth and justice don't necessarily enter the equation. The fact was, Abernathy probably made the right decision. With the confession recanted, there was no evidence to hold him, and Abernathy was already ticked at the prosecution. He was probably looking for a way to drop the hammer, and he did. We've both seen that before. Decker had participated in so many trials over the years that he felt he was a lawyer in every way, except as a holder of the official sheepskin and bar card.
I'm glad you can look at it in such a coldly efficient way, Amos.
She said, a distinct frostiness in her own tone. How else do you want me to look at it? He said just as bluntly. Otherwise, I've got my head in my ass. And where does that get us? She looked away and chewed her gum.
Forget it. I'm just having a shitty day.
Decker didn't tell her about his tailing and then losing Leopold at the bar. He didn't think it would add anything to the scenario, and he felt like an idiot for having let it happen. And even with an altered brain,
Who wanted to look like an idiot? The FBI seems excited, he observed. The suits were running around with an even greater degree of energy than they normally exhibited.
Mass murderer, connected cases, the stuff you found with Debbie Watson, it's definitely upped the stakes.
She paused and fiddled with some pages in front of her.
And they want to talk to you, Amos. The FBI, I mean.
He looked mildly surprised. Why is that?
Foremost, because you're the one discovering all the fresh clues. But it's also clear that the killer has a personal thing with you. The message at your old home was directed at you. The coded note at Debbie's house was about you, too. So the FBI wants to basically question you to see if they can get any leads from whoever might have a vendetta against you.
And when do they want to do this?
Now would be a good time, actually.
Decker looked up to see a 6-foot-tall, broad-shouldered man in his 40s standing next to him. His suit was impeccable, down to the yellow pocket square that neatly matched the tie. He was clean-shaven and fit. He seemed to be the leader of the pack, if the way the other agents were anxiously staring at him was any indication. Decker had never seen him before. He must have just arrived on the scene, perhaps from Washington. A heavy gun brought in for a heavy case that was gaining widespread attention across the country. It just seemed like the federal way. Leave the chicken shit cases to the local chickens while they grab the glory on the ones destined for the national pipeline. The man put out a hand and smiled, revealing a slight gap between his very white front teeth. Special Agent Ross Bogart. I'm a little late for the party. I was finishing up some things in D.C. Mr. Decker, let's find a quiet place to go over some things, if you don't mind. Would it matter if I did mind? We all have the same goal. I know you were a cop and then a detective. You know the drill, nothing too small, nothing too obscure to follow up. Shall we? He pointed to a door at the back of the library that Decker had previously discovered was used as a reading classroom for ESL students. He rose and followed the man back. Another agent joined them. A woman Decker had seen before. She was blonde in her 30s, with muscled calves and a jaw that jutted out like a slab of stone. She had a recorder in one hand and a notebook and pen in the other. A federal shield rode on her hip. Special Agent Lafferty will be joining us, said Bogart. How about Detective Lancaster joining us then, suggested Decker. She's been right in the middle of this, too. Maybe later, Bogart said with a smile, as he held open the door and flicked on the light. They all sat around a small table, Decker on one side, the two special agents on the other. Lafferty turned on her recorder and held her notebook open, looking ready to write down everything that was said in the room. Do they still teach shorthand with all the digital stuff they have these days? Asked Decker, looking at her. It seems that a recording would be 100% accurate, whereas your shorthand might contain interpretations and selective nuances, of which you might not be even consciously aware, instead of what was actually said. Just a thought. She did not seem to know how to respond to this, so she glanced at her boss. Bogart said, "Let's start at the beginning, if you will, to help me come up to speed. Why don't you just let me summarize so we don't waste time," said Decker. He didn't wait for an assent from Bogart, but plunged ahead. My family was killed 16 months ago. The case is unsolved. He then told the FBI agents about Sebastian Leopold's confessing to the crime, being jailed, recanting, and then being released because there was no evidence to hold him. As you know, ballistics has tied that case and this one together. And you're sure he couldn't have been the school shooter? Asked Bogart. Impossible. He was in jail at the time, hours before the guy started his rampage. You figured out where he might have been hiding? Said Bogart. In the cafeteria, the food locker? I tied some witness statements together and made an educated guess. Then you found the notebook in Debbie Watson's locker with the picture of the shooter. Another educated guess. Bogart went on, seeming not to have heard him. Then you went to Watson's house and made the discovery of the coded message held in the musical score, And then there was the earlier message, or taunt, really, that someone left on the wall of your old house where your family was murdered. You spotted that, too. Bogart paused for a moment and then said, "Aren't you going to say another educated guess?" "I guess I don't have to now, seeing as you said it for me." "You seem to be taking this all rather lightly. Can I ask why?" "I'm not taking any of this lightly. That's why I'm working the case even though I'm not on the police force." Bogart glanced at a file in front of him. "Cases, really, isn't it? Separated by 16 months? Actually, 16 months, 2 days, 12 hours, and 6 minutes." "And how do you know that so precisely? You didn't even look at your watch." "There's a clock on the wall behind you." Bogart didn't turn around and look, but Lafferty did, and she wrote something down. Decker hadn't needed to look at the wall clock. He had his internal timer that kept that count faithfully. Better than a Rolex and a lot cheaper. "Still," said Bogart. "To the minute?" "To the second, in case you're interested," replied Decker evenly. "And if you're wondering where I was when the school shooting was happening, I was at the second precinct." Bogart's brow furrowed, and he looked bemusedly at Decker. "Why would you offer up an alibi in the first place? Do you think you're under suspicion somehow?" "If you really think about it, everybody's under suspicion somehow." Decker watched as Lafferty wrote this down word for word. "Are you being deliberately antagonistic, Mr. Decker?" asked Bogart politely. "No. This is just my personality. Ask anyone who knows me. I have no filters. I lost them years ago and never found them again." "You had an outstanding record in the police force, you and your partner." "Former partner," Decker corrected, for he had a need for things to be precise, especially right now. "Former partner," conceded Bogart. "But in talks with people, it seems that you were the clear leader of the pair. I won't say you were the brains, because I have no desire to minimize Detective Lancaster's contributions to your casework." "That's very nice to hear," said Decker, "because Mary is a good detective and works her ass off." He looked at Lafferty. "And if you work hard, too, you might become more than a note-taker for your boss. I'm sure you have the ability, if you're ever given the chance to use it." Lafferty flushed and set her pen down. Bogart leaned forward. "This person seems to have a vendetta against you. Any idea who that could be?" "If I did, I would have already provided the information to the Burlington Police Department." "We're all in this together," said Bogart, who was no longer smiling politely. "I'm glad that you think so. So no one comes to mind. When I talked with Leopold, he said I had dissed him at the 7-Eleven. This was about a month before my family was killed. Only I never dissed anyone there. And if someone had a problem with me, I would have remembered."
"Are you saying your memory is infallible?"
"I'm saying I would have remembered if someone had a problem with me.
But all that time ago, you could have forgotten. And it might have been something slight or seemingly innocuous. It might not have even registered with you. We all miss things, and memories are inherently fallible."
"When were you born?"
"What?"
asked Bogart sharply. "Tell me when you were born. Month, day, year." Bogart glanced at Lafferty and then said, "June 2nd, 1968. Decker blinked 5 times and said, "Then you were born on a Sunday." Bogart sat back.
"That's right. I, of course, didn't know it at the time. How did you know?"
"Did you look up my personnel file? I wouldn't have had access. And until 5 minutes ago, I didn't even know you existed. If you want more proof, I can do the same thing for your colleague."
"And your point?"
"I would have remembered dissing someone at the 7-Eleven, whether it was 17 months or 17 years ago."
"You think Leopold was lying, then?"
"I think Sebastian Leopold is not what he wants us to think he is."
"And what exactly is that?"
"Homeless, and more than slightly out of his mind."
"So you're saying he's neither homeless nor out of his mind?"
"I'm saying that I think he's dangerous."
"But you said
He couldn't have been the school shooter. Do you think he killed your family?
He couldn't personally have done it. He has an alibi for that, too. But I'm rethinking whether he was still involved somehow.
Why?
Because he walked on a murder charge he confessed to, and now he's disappeared. You don't luck yourself into either one of those results.
So you do think he's involved somehow, and now he's disappeared?
I have no proof. And even if we find him, we can't charge him with what we have, which is basically nothing.
So why do you think he's involved?
This came from Agent Lafferty. Bogart turned to her, seemingly surprised that she had uttered actual words.
Decker stared dead at her.
Because he's inexplicable. And I don't like people who are inexplicable.
Chapter 26
Decker left Bogart and Lafferty in the little reading room and walked across the hall to the cafeteria. This was where it all started, and it seemed that the old checkerboard linoleum-floored space kept calling out to him.
Maybe like a siren serenades a sailor to his doom.
He walked around the perimeter of the space, looked in the freezer, turned the corner, and checked the kitchen area, then the outdoor loading dock, which led off into the woods. Initially, they thought the shooter had escaped that way.
Well, many of them still thought that,
which was why a forensics team had been scouring the entire path and its environs ever since Decker had discovered what he had in the cafeteria. But Decker no longer believed it. He came back in and parked himself in one of the chairs the kids used. His wide butt hung off both sides of it, and he could almost hear the scream of the seat's spindly legs as it supported a bulk not usually seen in a high school. So, why had the shooter really been in the cafeteria? It was far from where the shooting spree started. The farthest possible spot except for the office and the library. Places that would have had people in them at that time in the morning.
7:28. Melissa Dalton heard the whooshing sound as the freezer door opened.
8:41. Cammy Man was caught on video.
8:42.
Debbie Watson lost her face and her life. Basically 1 hour and 13 minutes were unaccounted for.
What took all that time?
If he was already dressed and gunned up, why had he waited? Or had he waited at all? Perhaps he was doing something. Perhaps he was doing something critical to his plan that took some time.
Decker sat there for a few minutes while his mind chewed on this.
No one had been seen walking from the cafeteria to the far hallway where Debbie Watson had died. They had identified and interviewed two people, both teachers, who most likely would have seen someone walk that route at that time. It was not guaranteed, because a minute off here and there, or a head turning to the right instead of the left, and there would have been a blind spot. But if the killer started in the cafeteria, he had to get to the other end of the school unseen. That was point A. He had done it. That was point B. Point C would be how he had done it. Point C was what Decker desperately needed to understand. And then something trickled into the back of his head, was run through the meticulous filters that his mind had become because of a hellacious hit by a bayou boy, and the trickle came out the other end, reformulated into something. Decker rose and hurried outside. He hustled over to the cornerstone of the school and read off the date. 1946. He already knew this, but looking at the numbers seemed to bolster his confidence in the theory forming in his head. Colors had flashed in his mind when his gaze fell on some of the numbers, but colors did not interest him right now. 1946. A year after the big war ended, and a new one had almost immediately begun. The Cold War. Nuclear war threats, Armageddon, kids huddling under their flimsy desks as part of emergency drills in case a hydrogen bomb was coming their way. As though an inch-thick laminate shield would protect them from the equivalent of 1,000,000 tons of TNT. Decker hustled back to the cafeteria, passing several suspicious-looking bureau agents in the hall as he did so. He didn't acknowledge them. He barely noticed them. He was on the scent. He had formed walls in his head that had compartmentalized everything down to this one line of inquiry that might answer the one question that seemed unanswerable. He stood in the middle of the room and looked in all four corners, then pulled his gaze back. He went into the kitchen and did the same thing. Then the loading platform. He didn't see anything remotely close to what he was looking for. The problem was, he didn't know enough. That was always the damn problem with police work. I don't know enough. The man who can't forget anything doesn't know enough. How ironic is that? But if Decker didn't know enough, then maybe the shooter didn't either. Maybe the shooter had had to turn to someone who did know enough. Or who knew someone who knew enough. Now that theory, if played out, might answer several questions. The school was a facility, a building. Changes could be made. Changes undoubtedly were made here over the decades. The drop ceiling over his head had assuredly not been here in 1946. What else had been added, or taken away, or covered up? Because it was no longer necessary? And then forgotten? Decker slipped into the library and motioned for Lancaster to join him. She finished up a phone call and then hurried over to the entrance to the library where Decker was standing. Decker was acutely aware that Special Agent Bogart and his Special Agent note-taker Lafferty were both watching him from a distant corner of the space. He spoke to Lancaster in a low voice, his features relaxed. He might just be shooting the breeze with her. They turned and left together. Once outside in the hall, Lancaster said,
"Do you really think it's possible? I mean, I never heard of such a thing."
"Just because you haven't heard of it doesn't mean it doesn't exist."
"You went here. Did you ever hear talk of something like that?"
"No, but then again, I never thought to ask either. And it might have been from a long time ago. In fact, it probably was."
"But who would know for sure? From what you said, it could have been put in over 60 years ago, and maybe never used. Anybody who might have known about it is probably dead or nearly so."
"How about students from back then?"
"Well, they'd be pretty elderly, too. And the teachers are almost certainly all dead."
"There has to be a way, Mary. Records have to be kept." They had walked outside, and Decker broke off his sentence as he looked to his left, where the old military base was. "The Army might have record of it," he noted.
"The Army? Why them?"
"The base has been here since what? The 30s?
"That's right. My grandfather worked there, along with half of the other people in Burlington. They had a big build-up during World War II, like every other military installation in the country."
"So clearly it was there before the school was built, and lots of parents who worked at the base sent their kids to Mansfield." Lancaster appeared to understand where he was going with this.
"So you think they might have initiated it?"
"And what if Debbie Watson's great-grandfather, who worked at the base starting in the late 60s, knew all about it and told little Debbie when he went to live with them?"
"And you think she might have told the shooter?"
"I can't think of another reason why he would have needed her."
"But how would he have found out that Debbie would know something like that?"
"It could have been any number of ways. That's not important. But if I'm right, we'll know how the shooter got from the cafeteria to the back hall unseen. And if we can nail that down, we might be able to work backward to where the son of a bitch came from." They hurried off to Lancaster's car. At the window watching them was Special Agent Bogart, and the man from Washington did not look pleased. Next to him, Special Agent Lafferty was busily writing down notes. Chapter 27. George Watson answered their knock. He looked disheveled, and there was a yellow and purplish bruise on his right cheek.
"Are you okay?"
asked Lancaster. Watson leaned against the door jamb, seemingly more for support than anything else. "I'm fine. My wife is leaving me, but I'm fine. Hell, why wouldn't I be?
Decker drew a foot closer and sniffed while Lancaster held Watson's gaze. Decker looked at her and nodded his head slightly. They had done the same routine when they had been partners. A nod for drunk, a shake of the head for sober, or near enough to it. Actually, he hadn't needed to do the smell test. The man's slurred speech, inability to stand without aid of a wall, and blurry eyes were signs enough.
"Is your wife here?" asked Decker.
George pointed inside the house.
"Packing, the bitch.
"These are very tough times for you both," commented Decker.
"Lost my little girl and now my wife. But you know what?"
"No, sir, what?" asked Decker.
"Screw 'em."
He waggled his deformed arm.
"Screw 'em."
"You might want to lie down, sir,"
said Lancaster.
"And lay off the drink."
George looked affronted.
"I haven't been drinking."
He let out a loud belch and looked like he might be sick.
"Good to know, but you need to sleep it off anyway."
Decker took the man's good arm and guided him into the front room and over to the couch. "Just lie down right there while we have a word with your wife." As George sank down onto the couch, he said,
"She's not my wife. Not anymore, bitch.
He closed his eyes and grew silent, except for his breathing. Decker led Lancaster down the hall and to a door behind which they heard noise. Decker rapped on the wood. "Mrs. Watson." They heard something fall and hit the floor.
"Who's there?"
Beth Watson barked.
"Police,"
said Lancaster. Beth Watson screamed.
"That little son of a bitch called the police? Just because I hit him? Well, he hit me first, the one-armed prick."
"It's not about that. It's about your daughter."
The door was wrenched open, and Beth Watson stood there in heels and a white slip and nothing else. Her pale flesh seemed even paler with that backdrop. The skin around her arms was sagging. One of her cheeks was red and swollen. Decker did not have to take a step closer to sniff out her sobriety status, but apparently she could be drunk, stand directly, and talk coherently at the same time. At least, she hoped she was coherent.
"What about her?"
Beth demanded.
"I asked your husband when we were here last time about his grandfather." Her brows knitted in confusion.
"Simon? Why?"
"He worked at McDonald Army Base before he retired."
"That's right. So what? He's been dead for years."
"But he lived here with you and your husband and Debbie."
"Yeah, again. So what?"
Unlike her husband, Beth didn't find it necessary to lean against the door jamb to steady herself. She obviously handled the booze better than her husband. Perhaps she had more practice, Decker thought. "Did he ever talk to you about his work there?" he asked.
"He was at the age where he only talked about the past. World War II, the Korean War, working for the government, blah, blah, blah. All day and all night. Sickening after a while. Who the hell wants to live in the past?"
She pushed past Decker and shouted down the hall.
"Who the hell wants to live in the past? George, not me. I'm all about the future now. My future. The past can kiss my ass. You can kiss my ass, you ball-less cripple."
Decker used his massive arm to gently guide her back into the room. "Did he ever mention to you any work done at Mansfield?" he asked. The woman's eyes seemed to wobble in their sockets.
"At Mansfield? He didn't work at Mansfield. He was at the Army base."
"Right, but the base and the school were right next to each other." She snagged a pack of cigarettes off the nightstand and lit up. She exhaled smoke and glared at Decker.
"I don't see what that has to do with a damn thing."
"The school was built right at the start of the Cold War, shortly after World War II ended.
People all over the country were putting bomb shelters in their backyards. Well, folks were doing that in buildings, too, including schools. Bomb-proof shelters under them. A hint of remembrance came into the woman's eyes.
Wait a minute. A long time ago, Simon did say something about a whatchamajigger at Mansfield. He didn't build it originally. He just added to it. I'd forgotten all about it. What whatchamajigger are we exactly talking about here?
Asked Lancaster pointedly. Beth pointed at Decker.
Like what he said, a place, a safe place under the school in case the Russians attacked us.
Soviets, corrected Decker. But close enough. Did he tell you anything about it? Like where it was located?
No, nothing like that. It was never used, apparently. And then I guess it got sealed up or something because they didn't want anyone sneaking down there. You know, high schoolers are full of hormones. You can only imagine what would go on down there.
She paused and said in a low voice,
orgies.
Then she giggled and hiccuped.
If I'd known about it when I went to school there, I'd been the first one doing it.
Then she screamed down the hall.
Orgies, you prick. That's what I'll be doing tomorrow. Orgies with other men. Lots of them.
Decker once more guided her back into the bedroom.
So a shelter is down there. Fortunate for us that you remembered that.
Noted Lancaster with a sideways glance at Decker. Beth gave a lopsided smile.
Actually, my memory sucks, but I remember Simon was talking to me about it while I was making dinner one night. Funny, I never listened to the old fart, and like I said, my memory is so bad. I never remember birthdays, shit like that, but I was making German chocolate cake when he was telling me about it. Only time I ever tried it. And I guess that's what triggered it. What triggered what?
Asked a confused Lancaster.
German chocolate cake. See, Germans and the Russians, they were in Germany, right? I mean, the Russians.
That's right, said Decker. They were. At least half of it. She smiled.
Weird how the brain works.
Tell me about it, said Decker. Did Simon have any friends in town who might still be around and who might know about this underground place?
Not that he ever mentioned. I mean, he was over 90 when he died. Now he'd be close to 100. They're all dead, right?
She added quietly.
Like my Debbie.
There was an awkward silence until Decker said, If you remember anything else, please give Detective Lancaster here a call. It's important. We want to find who did this. Who did this to... Debbie.
You still think she was in cahoots with whoever did this?
No, I really don't. The woman's lips trembled.
Debbie was a good kid.
I'm sure she was, which makes it even more important that we find out who did this. Lancaster glanced at the partially packed suitcase.
Look, it's none of my business, but do you think you should be making that sort of drastic change right after losing your daughter? It might be better for you and your husband to get through this together, and then you can make some decisions. Knee-jerk tends to come back to bite you in the butt.
Beth looked at her cross-eyed.
I wanted to leave 2 years ago, but I stayed for Debbie's sake. Well, Debbie's not here anymore, so I'm not wasting another second of my life in this fucking place. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to finish packing so I can get the hell out of here.
She slammed the bedroom door in their faces.
So much for better or worse,
said Lancaster. For some people, the longer the marriage, the worse it gets, said Decker. But at least we know my theory might work out. Simon did know something at the school, an underground shelter.
So now what do we do?
Let's go outside. You can smoke a cigarette, and I can make some phone calls.
You know, I can quit anytime I want.
He stared at her. No, you can't, Mary. You're addicted to nicotine.
I was making a joke. Damn, do you have to take everything so literally?
But Decker was already on his cell. It took 3 phone calls and being passed from one person to the next before Decker found someone who sort of knew what he was talking about. He patiently explained who he was and what he wanted.
Mansfield?
Said the woman on the other end of the line.
Where the mass shooting took place?
That's right, said Decker. We're trying to figure out how the killer got in and out. Since it was so close to McDonnell Army Base, we thought there might be something there. Turns out we learned there is an underground passage or facility of some kind. We'd like confirmation of that, and also particulars on how to get in there, so we don't have to tear the whole school down looking for it.
I'm going to need something in writing on the appropriate letterhead to get this request verified and initiated.
Okay, but once verified and initiated, how long will it take? We're looking for a murderer, someone who killed a bunch of kids. The longer it goes, the farther away he gets.
I wish I could tell you it would be fast, but this is the United States Army. The only place we move fast is on the battlefield. The stuff behind the lines, not so much.
Decker got the information on where to send the request and clicked off. He looked over at Lancaster, who had been leaning against the hood of her car all this time, and had whittled down not one, but 3 cigarettes, while Decker had been playing whack-a-mole with the Army. Lancaster dropped her last smoke and ground it into the asphalt with the heel of her shoe.
And?
And we might all be dead of old age before they get back to us.
So what now?
So it looks like we'll have to find it ourselves. Chapter 28 Decker and Lancaster pace the cafeteria, working from opposite ends of the space.
So it makes sense an entrance would be in here.
Said Lancaster.
Big room, get lots of students assembled in here, and then down into the shelter in the event of an emergency.
Decker nodded but said nothing. She continued.
If it's here, it must be hidden behind something, maybe the appliances?
Decker shook his head. It couldn't be something that involved. With an emergency, you would have to have fast access.
But it was probably boarded up.
Lancaster pointed out.
Built over.
But the shooter still couldn't be tearing into walls, floors, or ceilings, because that would also make noise and leave evidence behind of how he went from here to the back hall.
Well, he did leave evidence he was in here. The spoiled food, remember?
He did that on purpose. He could have easily turned the temp back down before he came out of it. Hell, he didn't have to stay in the freezer all night anyway. He wanted us to know he was here, but he didn't want us to find out how he got from the front to the back, at least not right away. That's the reason he left the trace in the ceiling and the tile dust on the floor. Classic misdirection. He's screwing with us, and he's costing us time. All good for him and bad for us. Lancaster kept glancing around.
So we're looking for an entrance in here that's been sealed up. We just don't know how or where.
The term sealed can mean a lot of different things. But the point is our guy befriended Debbie for one reason and one reason only, to learn about this passage.
Come on, Decker, how would he even know about it to ask her?
I found out about it based on observations and hunches and a little research. He could have done the same. This is a relatively small town. He could have found out Simon Watson worked at the base any number of ways. He could have learned he once lived with the Watsons. He could have approached Debbie to see if she knew anything about it. And of course she did.
That takes a lot of planning and forethought.
And that apparently is a strong suit for our guy. Decker walked back and forth in front of a section of the wall. Lancaster noted this and said,
I bet those rules haven't changed in 60 years. I suppose you adhered to all of them when you went here?
She added with a smile tacked on. The rules she was referring to were posted on a large section of the wall that Decker was studying. They included no loud talking, no throwing food, no eating off someone else's plate, No milk cartons left on tables, all trash in the garbage, no running, and on and on.
Amos, I said...
He held up his hand for her to stay quiet, while he circled the wall and then looked at the floor. What do you see down there, Mary? She bent low and looked where he was pointing.
Some marks, probably from a student's shoes.
I don't think so. There's no uniform requirements at Mansfield. Most boys wear sneakers. And from what I've seen, most girls wear sneakers, flats or chunky heels. That footwear wouldn't leave those sorts of marks. It's actually scraped into the linoleum. And they're not short, like a heel might make. They're long, and they're on a slight curve. Looks to be a few of them.
Well, what do you think they are?
He stood closer to the section of wall where the rules were printed on a massive piece of wood, painted to match the wall color. The wood ran down to the floor and nearly to the ceiling. No hinges evident, he said. But he dug his fingers under the right section of the wall and tugged at various spots. He did this on the other side. Finally, after 10 minutes of probing, tugging, and pushing, there was a little click, and the entire section behind the sign opened outward. He pulled on it, opening it farther. Revealed behind it was a pair of old wooden doors, painted the color of the wall. "Look at the floor," said Decker. Lancaster noted another set of fresh scuff marks where the wood had dragged in one place across the floor when he'd opened the section.
Damn, Amos. The mark on the floor was from the door swinging open.
Hinges were placed about a foot in and mounted on a support structure so they wouldn't be visible to anyone. But the hinges have sagged a bit over time, hence the scuffed floor. He ran his finger along one set of hinges and his finger came away darkened. "Recently oiled," he said. There was a small knob in the center of the back of the section.
What do you think that was for?
Decker thought for a few moments. You'd use it to pull shut the wall section once you're on that side of it.
Right. But why even have a door at all? If they wanted to seal it up, why not just seal it up?
I don't know, Mary. It must have cost a lot of money to build. Maybe they wanted to have reasonably easy access to it if they ever decided to use it again.
I guess.
I don't see any fingerprints. But let's not take chances. They call them latent prints for a reason. He grabbed a knife from a box of them on one of the kitchen counters to ease open the door by pushing back on the ordinary lock that secured the two doors. The door opened silently, showing that its hinges had been recently oiled, too. There was a long set of steps down into inky darkness. Decker grabbed an emergency flashlight from a holder on the wall next to the serving counter and came back over to the doorway. You ready?
Shouldn't we alert the others?
Said Lancaster nervously. We will, after we see where this goes.
But the FBI?
Screw the FBI, Mary. This is our case, not theirs. He stared at her. You with me? She finally nodded and followed him down the steps. They reached the bottom, and here Decker stopped and shone his light around. Look there. They saw that set against one wall were two large sections of painted plywood. Bent nails were sticking out of them. Decker said, That's how they really sealed up the passage. I saw nail holes in the perimeter around the double doors. That plywood had been nailed in front of the doors. If anyone figured out the sign opened, all they'd see is a solid wall.
You think the shooter did that?
Decker shone his light on the floor. Had to be. The sawdust on the floor looks relatively fresh. If he pulled out the nails, the dust would come out and fall to the floor. Same when he hauled the sections down the steps. And he might have used a saw to cut through the wood, too.
Which means he had to have done this before. No way is he tearing out wood walls during the school day. Too much noise.
He could have done it the night before. He comes out of the freezer and gets to work. No one here to hear anything. He opens the wall with a sign on it, cuts through the wall, opens the doors, and puts everything down in the passageway.
If he did all that, Amos, maybe that's why he hid in the freezer.
Could be, said Decker. Decker pointed to the floor once more. In the dust were clear sets of shoe prints, heading in the direction they were going. Two clear sets of footprints, heading down the passage. Walk to the right, Mary, so we preserve them, and take shots of them with your phone camera as we go.
Okay, but why two sets? Are they two different people?
Decker bent down and shone the light on them. No. The prints look to be identical. And it's not two people walking side by side. The spacing of the prints is too close. But two sets make sense.
Why?
Come on. They continued on, with her taking pictures as they went. They passed through a massive, foot-thick metal door that only opened easily because it was set on hydraulic hinges. Some sort of blast door, said Decker. Now the space opened up into a large room about 40 feet across and twice as long. The floors were concrete, the walls and ceiling the same. On the walls were signs that told what to do in the event of an emergency. Several were imprinted with a skull and crossbone symbol, the universal sign for danger. Along the walls were old metal lockers, on which were bolted signs. One read, "Gas masks." Another said, "First aid." A third said, "Water and food." The dust and cobwebs were pervasive, and the air stale and musty. They must have had an independent air supply, said Decker. If a nuke hits, you couldn't have access to the outside air.
But it can't be airtight down here. I can breathe okay.
Which means it might have been vented, so workers down here replenishing supplies and the like could breathe, but they close them off when the alarm sounds. Following the sets of footprints, they traversed the bomb shelter space and passed through another blast door where there was another passageway matching the one on the other side. The darkness was lifted every few seconds by the flash on Lancaster's phone as she took pictures of the sets of shoe prints that had continued on down the passage. Decker was counting off the steps in his head. Then they ran into another set of steps. These headed up. Decker had been shining his light on the floor at various intervals. The shoe prints they had seen earlier had paralleled them the entire way. They headed up. At the top of the steps was a blank wall.
Dead end?
Can't be. Decker dug his fingernails around the edges of the wall, working his way up and down both sides. Then he gained a handhold, tugged. The wall started to give, and then it came loose. It's balsa wood, he said, hefting it easily and setting it aside. On the other side of the open wall was a small space that was stacked with junk. On the other side of that was a door.
The government wouldn't have sealed it with balsa wood.
I'm sure they didn't. But unlike the cafeteria where the wall wasn't visible, this wall would have been in case someone opened the door. The shooter must have replaced whatever wall was here with the balsa. It would look solid, but would be easily movable.
You're talking a lot of work, Amos. He couldn't have done all that in one night.
But if he could access the school at night, he might have been here a lot doing what he needed to do.
But how would he do that? He couldn't count on school plays every night, and bringing in saws and other equipment?
I'm not sure how he did it. Decker hit the floor with his light. Check out the patch right in front of the wall. Not much dust. That pile of junk used to be right in front of the wall. But it's been moved, so it doesn't block the way. Decker checked the doorknob for prints, and then used the knife he'd brought with him to try to force the latch open. It's locked. Give me a sec. He passed the flashlight to her and pulled from his pocket his lock-picking instruments.
Standard PI equipment?
You never picked a lock as a cop? A minute later, the door swung open about a foot or so and then hit something.
What is it?
Whispered Lancaster. Decker noted that she had her gun out and that her left hand was still trembling. Something blocking the door. He poked his head through the opening and recognized where they were. "This is the storage room off the shop class. I looked in here before. The door's hitting a stack of old window AC units. That's why I didn't see the door before. The units completely hid it from where I was standing on the other side."
"And I bet, when we searched this area, no one noticed the door on the other side for the very same reason."
"Sounds right." Lancaster eyed the gap.
"I can get through there."
She turned sideways and passed easily through the narrow space. She looked around.
"If you can push on the door from your end, I'll steady the AC unit so they don't fall over."
He pushed on the door with his bulk, and the door slid open farther, pushing the units with it, while Lancaster held on to them, keeping them upright.
"Okay, Amos, that's plenty of room for you to get through."
Decker passed through the widened gap, looked at the partially open door, and then at the stack of AC units, and then stared down at the floor. And then he frowned.
"What now?"
asked Lancaster. "There's not a lot of dust in here, so I don't see any more shoe prints."
"But we saw the sets coming up the stairs. He had to come in here."
"Agreed. So let's assume he came through here and out into the shop class. They left the storage area and walked into the large room with all the tools and work tables. But how did the guy know there'd be no one in shop class?" said Decker.
"Oh, didn't you know?"
said Lancaster, sounding pleased. She knew something Decker didn't. "Know what?"
"The shop teacher quit at the end of last year. They couldn't find a replacement, so there's been no shop class this year."
"That's why the door to the classroom was locked. And that's also how the shooter knew. Debbie must have told them that there was no shop class."
"But you were right, Amos. This is how he got from the cafeteria to the opposite end of the school, unseen."
He nodded. "He actually did it twice that day. He came out of the freezer, walked down the passage, came out into the halls, shot the people on his way to the front. Then he re-entered the passage in the cafeteria, closed the wall after him, and walked back down the passage."
"Which was why there were two sets of identical shoe prints."
"Right. Now, the shop class is also a big space, so maybe they figured to load kids from both sides of the school and down into the shelter in the event of an emergency."
"How far underground do you figure that passage was?"
"Based on the number of risers, about 12 feet."
"Doubt that would protect you from a nuclear bomb blast, even if it's all concrete with reinforced doors."
He stared at her. "Well, what exactly would protect you from a nuke?"
"Good point."
"I came in here the first night I was here looking around. Those are my shoe prints over there." He pointed to the far wall. "I walked around, then like I said before, I looked in the storage rooms in the back." Decker knelt down and studied the floor. "Mary, hit this section with your light. I must have missed it earlier." Lancaster did so, revealing a long mark that disturbed the light dust, along with the impressions of shoe prints.
"What do you think that is?"
"Point your light about 6 inches to the left." She did. There was nothing. "Try 6 inches to the right." She did. And they saw an identical mark.
"What is that?"
"Marks from Debbie Watson's feet."
"Her feet?"
"Or her heels, rather, as she was being dragged out of here. The shoe prints are the shooter's."
"Out of here? What was she doing in here?"
"Meeting her beau, her Jesus."
"You aren't serious."
"Debbie was the first Vic the ME did a post-mortem on. Did you read the autopsy report?"
"Of course I did."
"COD?"
"Why are you wasting time, Amos? Her cause of death was a shotgun blast to the face, as you very well know."
"That was obvious. But did you know what the coroner found in her mouth?"
"You mean aside from shotgun pellets?"
Lancaster said sarcastically. "He found the residue of some breath mints."
"Breath mints? I don't remember reading that."
"It was near the end of the report. I always read to the end."
"But breath mints?"
"Residue of breath mints. There was a pack of them in her locker. Two were missing. That's why she went to her locker, to get the mints, to freshen up her breath before meeting her beau and her killer. And that would explain the time gap. He comes out of the freezer at 7:28.
He goes down the passage, but he has to wait for Debbie to get out of class. They probably had a prearranged time. She fakes being ill, gets her permission slip, goes to her locker, gets her mints, and then enters the shop class.
But you said the door was locked.
Jesus would have unlocked it from the inside for her.
Right.
She eyed him suspiciously.
Exactly how long have you thought all this?
Not that long. Decker closed his eyes and touched the back of his head about halfway down. And the autopsy revealed that there was a subacute subdural hematoma on the back of her head, right about here. Left side of the occipital bone was cracked, and that's a tough bone to damage like that. That might have killed her if the shotgun hadn't, just from internal bleeding and resulting pressure on the brain. The ME speculated the injury occurred when she fell backward to the floor after being shot. He opened his eyes and looked at his partner. Left side.
Meaning the blow came from the left side and behind? A left-handed person. Like you said, the guy who wrote the musical score was left-handed.
The probabilities lie there, yes.
So he meets her in here and knocks her out, but why?
He needed her out of the way. And he needed to kill her first before anyone else. He couldn't risk the possibility that she would survive. She could identify him. So he arranges to meet with her, uses the passageway to get across the school unseen. I would imagine this is not the first time they've done this. They might have had sex in shop class during or after school on other occasions. I wonder how often Debbie got permission to go to the nurse's office.
Have sex? Are you serious?
Their own private space in the middle of the school? What could be cooler for a teenager in love with her mature man who doesn't even go here? And the killer would have wanted to know the passage by heart when he was planning this whole thing. He could bring stuff in and store it here. It was perfect.
So how do you see it playing out from there?
He meets in the shop class with her. She thinks to make out, hence the breath mints. He knocks her out, gets his gear, slips out of the room, walks around the corner to the camera, and gets his picture taken. He glanced at Lancaster. You saw the shoe prints in the passage.
You know I did.
I estimate they're a size 9 or maybe 9.5, but no larger. Lancaster looked confused.
That's not very big for a large guy. Earl's 6 feet and he wears an 11.
I'm 6'5 and wear a 14 shoe, which is not unusual for a man my size. A guy 6'2 weighing in at 200+ pounds with a size 9 shoe? Not likely. And I couldn't get past the gap in the door with the AC units in the way. I had to push them out farther. And the lack of marks on the floor showed I was the only one who had. You got through easily enough, but you're short and skinny. The guy in the video had a lot smaller waist than I do, but his shoulders and chest were just as broad as mine. So how did he manage to get through the gap without moving the AC units?
I don't know. Do you?
I've got some ideas. Lancaster looked around nervously and chewed her gum so ferociously that her teeth were clacking together.
We need to get a forensics team in here. I hope to God we haven't already tainted evidence. The Bureau will rip us a new one after Mac finishes with us.
She looked around, and then something else seemed to strike her.
Wait a minute. If the guy knocked Debbie out and then dragged her out of here, how did he shoot her standing up out in the hall? The ballistics was clear on that. She was upright. Blood spatters don't lie, and there was only a minute gap between his picture being captured on the video and him killing Debbie.
There was a hole in the back of her jacket, right where it would sit behind her neck, Decker said. He probably hooked the jacket on her locker door. It could keep her upright for a short time. He slips around the corner, gets his image captured on the video, comes back around the corner and shoots her. The blast would have knocked her down. That's when the jacket tore, when it was jerked off the locker door when she fell. Decker shone his light around the room and picked up more shoe prints, including a set leading back into the storage room and then back down to the passageway. There were also footprints in the shop class belonging to Debbie Watson. She had worn clunky boots. They had been on her body. In the prints on the floor, Decker could see a picture of activity forming. The two sets of footprints had gotten very close together, probably when they had been kissing. She had been anticipating sex with the man she called Jesus, and instead, she'd been thrown right into an early grave. Decker leaned against the wall and rewound his DVR until he stopped at the point he wanted. "Did you notice something else down in the passageway, Mary?"
"Something else? Like what?"
He opened his eyes. There were two sets of shoe prints going up the stairs to the storage room off the shop class.
"Right."
"And there was a set coming back down the stairs."
"Right again. So?"
"And while there were scuffed prints all over the place, showing that he used this passage before, there were no clear sets of shoe prints going back down the passage to the cafeteria to match the two sets coming from the front of the school to the back." Lancaster's eyes widened.
"Damn, that's right. So how did our guy escape from the school?"
"Now that's a really good question." Chapter 29. While Lancaster hurried off to alert her colleagues to this new development, Decker slipped back down into the passageway and reached the bottom of the stairs. So if the shooter hadn't gone back down this passage and escaped via the cafeteria or gone out the front or rear doors where someone surely would have seen him, then where did he go? The school had been searched, including the unused upper floors, and nothing had been discovered. The police hadn't known about this passageway, of course, and thus it had not been searched. But the guy was not down here now. He had walked down the stairs from the shop class storage area and gone... where? Decker hit the area all around the bottom of the stairs with his flashlight. There were two blank walls on either side of the stairs. There was no dust here, and thus the shoe prints had ended at the bottom of the stairs. He looked at this spot again. But why was there no dust here, when it was everywhere else? Had someone cleaned it away? If so, why? He could think of at least one reason. It was something someone had said to him. It had been a very recent statement. Beth Watson. She was packing up to leave her husband. Her husband's grandfather had told her about the passageway. But she also said something else that Simon had told her. He didn't build it originally. He just added to it. Decker stepped closer to the wall on the right and hit the surface from all angles with his light. Nothing. He did the same on the left. Something. A slight seam where the wall met the stairs. He dug his fingers into this gap and pulled, and the wall opened on hinges, smoothly and without noise, just like the fake wall back in the cafeteria. It had been recently used. Decker was peering down a long, dark hall. The air in here was stale and musty as well, but not overly so, which meant fresh air was getting in somehow, somewhere. He moved down the passage, his light hitting the dirty concrete floor. There were shoe prints, again size 9 or so. He took pictures of them with his cell phone camera. He stopped when he saw the door. Leaning next to this door and against the wall were sections of plywood with bent nails protruding from them, like back in the cafeteria. They had been used to seal off this end of the passage, but someone had unsealed it. The shooter. He pulled his gun, touched the wood of the door, and eased it open. He shone his light ahead. He could hear water dripping, the scurry of what he assumed were rats, and the beating of his own heart. Decker was a brave man because you did not go into his line of work without being braver than average. But he was also scared because you did not go into his line of work, or at least survive very long in it, without a commonsensical understanding of your own mortality. He moved ahead. The floor sloped upward after 100 feet. Then he reached a set of steps. He took them up, trying to keep as quiet as possible. There was another door at the top. It was locked. He tried his lockpick. It didn't work. He tried his shoulder, with over 350 pounds of bulk behind it. That did work. He came out in the semi-darkness and looked around. The room he was in was large, with windows set up high. There was a smell of grease and oil. And as he looked around, he saw the skeletons of vehicles scattered here and there. They were old, abandoned army vehicles, because he was now standing in one of the buildings of the long-closed McDonnell Army Base. A passage connecting a school with an army base? But the more he thought about it, the more it made sense. Lots of kids who went to Mansfield back then had parents who worked at the base. In the event of an emergency, what better place for the kids than either in the bomb-proof shelter underneath the school or at the base with their parents? Or maybe the underground shelter was designed to hold both base personnel and the school kids. Whatever the truth, it was also a fact that it had long since been forgotten about, and it was probably never even used. But he corrected himself.